Ramana, welcome to Cable again.
Thank you, Bill.
Ramana is a distinguished physicist. Over the years, came to recognize that climate change joins nuclear weapons and accidents like Fukushima as looming threats to human life. He's known internationally for his work on how to replace both nuclear and fossil fuel energy, and in the process, restore planetary ecosystems that has replaced them with clean sun and wind energy. He's taught, researched, written, and agitated at the Nuclear Futures Laboratory and the Program on Science and Global Security, both at Princeton U. He's now at the University of British Columbia School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. He and several colleagues recently wrote the article, How Electric Utilities Thwart Climate Action, Politics and Power. That's in this month's edition of the Journal Against the Current. The article discusses one of several ways that the investor-owned utilities and their financiers and investors are trying to remain in control and make huge profits by stifling the growth of public community electricity providers who are far more quickly, cheaply, and reliable building systems such that their cities and counties become 100% carbon. There are many of them now in the United States. Earlier this year, The Mole interviewed Ramana on those private investor-owned utilities on their false claims about the alleged safety of the newest small designs for nuclear power plants that they are planning to construct across the country and planet. Last week, we discussed another of their dangerous plans, that is to use natural gas as a bridge fuel before they begin building out their nuclear power stations and sun and wind farms. They want to get the most out of their coal and primitive natural gas plants before they change. This, of course, ignores scientific warnings that we must go to clean sun and wind energy in the next 10 years, which natural gas is surely not clean energy if we hope to survive. Today, we will switch gears, go positive, discuss how the U.S. and the nations of the world can reject the plans and expensive technologies of the private investor-owned utilities like PG&E and Pacific Power. Instead, we have to immediately build out sun and wind-based generations that can respond to the threat of climate change in a very short amount of time. This is climate scientists believe is necessary. So, Ramana, tell us about those strategies.
Yeah, I think we have to think about this in two ways. One is, there are, as you mentioned, a very large suite of technologies that are ready to deploy, that are relatively cheap, and which can be brought online at very short order, within a decade or two. These are the well-known solar and wind technologies, but also a whole range of technologies that can change the demand side, the demand that is for electricity that's being created, and how it can be shaped in multiple ways, either by making appliances that one uses more efficient, by changing when we use some of these things so that it matches better with when the energy flows into the system come in. One of the complaints that you hear from the industry and by mainstream media, including people like Bill Gates and so on, is that the sun and wind energy are not reliable. Cliche they use is that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And of course that is true, but it doesn't rain all the time. That hasn't stopped us from being able to get water when we turn the tap on. Likewise, there are ways by which one can manage an electricity grid that can deal with the variability of solar and wind power and manage the grid efficiently so that you can still get your electricity reliably. Okay? That said, there's also a more basic question that we have to ask, which is going back to the discussion we had earlier about how the elite would like us to try to keep the current system as it is without changing anything fundamental, and yet deal with climate change, and I explained why that is an impossible quest. So the question we have to ask ourselves, at least those people who would like to see ourselves as progressives or those who are sort of questioning the system, the question we have to ask ourselves is, you know, what aspects of the system do we have to maintain and what do we not have to maintain? Right? Or what should we actually let go? And in that sense, I would say the mainstream discussion completely neglects the question of what uses we think are legitimate and what are not. So if you think about a different area, which is transportation, where, again, we would have to reduce our emissions drastically, and we have to ask, you know, how can we do it? One option that is presented to us is to, say, move to electric cars from internal combustion vehicles. This is what the dream that, you know, Elon Musk and Tesla sell us. And that's fine as it is, but it never brings up the question, two questions which never come up. One is, you know, is a car the most efficient way for people to go from one place to the other? How about public transportation? How do we make it more accessible, more affordable, and more easy for people to use? And what kinds of investments need to go in there? That question almost never comes up. And the second question, of course, is also what kind of transport patterns are being engendered upon us by the current system of where houses are, where jobs are, what kinds of transportation is being required, you know, how the concentration of groceries and so on in large shops as opposed to neighborhood shops. All these multiple things contribute to the demand for energy in this world, and we have to be thinking about all of those things. Now, those things take time, but the focus on technology means that all of those social and political questions completely get swept aside. And I think it's important for people who see themselves as progressives to be asking those questions, to be probing those directions of changes.
Hi, folks. This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Ramana, a physicist, a scholar, an activist who, like the great majority of climate scientists, challenged the corporate elite's plans for dealing with the threat of climate change. One element of the corporate plan is for using nuclear power and natural gas to meet the challenge of climate change while slowly, slowly building out sun and wind installations in remote places and also building out huge, high-security, continent-spanning, high-voltage grids to deliver the power to consumers who most live in cities. Ramana emphasizes the necessity of very swiftly building out sun and wind generation of electric power. He also challenges the corporate elite's plan to use bridge fuels and slowly build out sun and wind, and also challenges the corporate plan to keep near everything about U.S. society, but its energy supply unchanged. That's, for example, maintaining cars as dominant in human transport and building more highways instead of public transit. We now continue the interview examining the corporate attack and the potentials for community energy networks to stop global roasting. Another claim by the investor-owned utilities and all the others who, in fact, are opposed to the sun and wind technologies that could put them out of business, actually, and those technologies that, if they were implemented by people who actually are interested in something other than profit, another one of their claims is that, look, we want sun and wind as much as anybody else. But we want to do it efficiently by putting plants in just the right areas with the maximum steady winds and the maximum steady sun. And then we need a big grid to transport all that energy, a big grid crossing rivers and mountains and forests and setting those forests afire. Of course, they don't talk about that, or the damage that would be done by setting up a whole new interstate transportation system of electricity crisscrossing everywhere through farmland as well, which would take a huge amount of time to build out, but they don't talk about that either. How do you reply to the people who say, look, the sun shines everywhere, the wind blows everywhere, that's at different speeds, but we, in fact, but the wind turbines and solar panels will, in fact, create a lot of energy in places where it isn't sunny and windy all the time, like in Germany and California, in fact, where there's a lot of sun, or in fact in Maine, where studies have been done. Maine is relatively cloudy in the United States, and yet it has a very large amount of wind and sun. What do you make of that, that we can locally produce sufficient amounts of energy to power a very modern and decent society?
Yes, there's definitely a lot of studies that show that, you know, one can produce a lot of power locally. There are, I think, two separate problems there. One problem is that if you're talking about cities, for example, I live in Vancouver and I live in a rented apartment here, and so my apartment block has about 100 apartments, and the rooftop space we have is not going to be adequate for that. And, you know, in more suburban or rural settings, this is not going to be a problem. But if you want to minimize the amount of transportation, it is good to have certain concentrated settlements as well. So there is a trade-off between how we reduce our demands for energy for transportation with the amount of energy that we can produce locally. So that's one issue. The second issue is that, as you mentioned, if homeowners, those of the homeowners who can put up solar panels on their roofs and so on, start doing that, then it starts affecting the profit model that utility companies are built on, right? They are built on selling you electricity. And if you're going to be generating most of your electricity yourself, then that's going to affect their profitability. And so there's a lot of pushback. And there is pushback started maybe about a decade ago. And the so-called Edison Institute, which is an institution that tries to represent the interests of electric utilities, it put up a report saying basically we seem to be going into a debt spiral. So what they were envisioning is more and more households start putting up solar panels, they reduce their demand for grid electricity, but the grid still has to be there because there are going to be some people who don't have access to solar power on their rooftops, and also the households that have solar power might be using the grid during those times when there is no sun. And so the grid has to exist, but it is going to exist on a smaller and smaller rate base. Therefore, they're going to become more unprofitable. They'll have to cut down their costs, which then means that the grid will become more unreliable, and so on and so forth. And this was the debt spiral, a vicious loop that the utility companies were seeing. And they started pushing back by saying, we will not support policy measures like net metering, which means that you actually can get paid for the electricity that you export to the grid. If you're not using the electricity then that your solar panel is producing, then you can actually give it to the grid and get credits for that. And that is a program called net metering, which these electric utility companies didn't like. And so there's a lot of battles in multiple states that have been going on since then about what the rate for the net metering should be, whether it should be allowed at all, et cetera, et cetera. So there are these two levels at which I think this is going to be a problem for the current system. But you're absolutely correct. In principle, the more energy we can generate locally, the better it is. It is true that, you know, the larger utility scale plant is typically going to cost less than a rooftop solar field simply because of the economies of scale that are there. You know, for somebody to be able to put up something on their rooftop means that a professional will have to come, you know, install it on the rooftop. It takes like a day or something of that sort, whereas in a day, they can probably install 100 of these panels on a big field. But the converse of it is that if you're trying to do things on your rooftop locally in small scale, then you're going to be generating far more jobs for the same amount of electricity that you're producing. And that's a good thing because it feeds back into the local economy. So there are going to be advantages for doing it locally, which are benefiting local people as opposed to distant corporations.
By locally, we don't mean, though, just around the corner or even a mile away. Locally can be 20 or 30 or 40 miles away, and still we save billions, trillions of dollars on having these much smaller, lower voltage, much more easy to repair, much more reliable local grids than scaling mountains and going over rivers and ruining farmlands that the utilities seem to think is necessary to maintain control of the system.
It all depends on how we shape the demand for energy.
Right. There'll be many large plants, but they'll be strategically located as near as possible.
Yeah, the aim would be to optimize the system so that you require less of these kind of mega grids, transmission corridors being cut across different states. And yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it was really good talking to you, Ramana. I hope we can talk again about how this energy revolution is now beginning to proceed. Hey, thanks a lot, Ramana.
Thank you, Bill. Lovely talking to you. Okay, take care.
Good talking to you. Thank you. You just heard an interview with Ramana, a distinguished physicist and several international scientific groups studying and suggesting alternative courses. That is alternative to now dominant corporate plans, looks at distraction and threats of nuclear reactors and climate change through community energy. You can find Ramana's previous KABU interviews by going to the KABU website, finding the search box on the homepage upper right, and typing in Ramana, R-A-M-A-N-A.